Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host, Dan, radio health legend, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Hey Ho, the Holly Show. Our salute to those, I guess it's, if it's a dog day of August, it's got to be a cat day of winter when nothing is going right. We're drowning in mud if we're not freezing, snow every weekend.
Really, right now it'd be more of a seal, wouldn't it? Wet and cold.
In fact, it is a nasty time of the year. And it's time to remember one of Shakespeare's more lackluster effort. I suppose it's a song, it's a sonnet, "Blow, Blow, Thou Winter Wind" by William Shakespeare. And it goes like this, "Blow, blow, thou winter wind, thou art not so unkind as a man's ingratitude. Thy tooth is not so keen because thou art not seen, although thy breath be rude. Hey ho, sing, hey ho unto the green holly. Most friendship is feigning, most loving mere folly. Then hey ho the holly, this life is most jolly." That's William Shakespeare.
Shouldn't you have sung that?
That's...
Oh, please stop. Stop. No, uncle.
No, and I just thought, well, I've heard better. I mean, you know, we go, "Oh, ho the mistletoe," and he went, "Hey, ho the holly," and I think we could do better than that. At any rate, thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, special radio wave to MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. And now it's time to introduce my co-medical host, first of all, from the University of Kentucky, assistant professor with the Physician Assistant Program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And welcome back. And then, unfortunately, due to an error in our spring programming from the university...
Actually, you just needed a ride.
This is the Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure to explain to you once again how to access Health Matters on the wild world of web, Rick Phillips. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Tony, you know I'm going to try to remember this because it's been a long time, right? You know, you can get the audio of the shows at WMKY.org. That's right, Moorhead State Public Radio's website. You got to look a little bit, but you'll find us in the menus. There's a show there called Health Matters. Look us up, look us down. There's all kinds of information in there on the shows that we do. There's a short summary. Most importantly, there's a link to the audio. This is how you listen to us over and over and over. So if you want to go back and listen to the old shows, there's how you do it, right there on WMKY.org. After that, you know, we did a little bit of interacting over the break with some of our fans, facebook.com/HMRadioShow, and you can interact. You can leave us messages, do some asynchronous communication, ask questions, you know, question what we're saying, give us some show topics. It's there. It's for your use, and it is the two-way way to interact with Health Matters, facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
The two-way way to interact. I love that. The palindromes interest me, and so there you are. You've got a two-way way to interact with us. Very.
Shakespeare ain't got nothing on me.
Right. I can tell you who can use the word.
You should see Shelley's face right now. It's pretty embarrassing.
Our sponsor for today's show, the top 10 threats to global health. Boy, that'll make you serious up on it. This was a list from the World Health Organization, the top 10 threats to global health in 2019 that will require attention from the World Health Agency. And this is sort of their set of priorities. First priority, and these may be surprising to you because, again, these are world health problems. Number one, the world health problem, according to the World Health Organization, air pollution and climate change. 9 out of 10 people breathe polluted air every day. Air pollution will kill 7 million people prematurely every year. And this is from diverse diseases like cancer, stroke, heart disease, lung disease. All these things are worsened by breathing in polluted air. Most in low and middle income countries that have high volumes of emissions. And also, it can even be inside the house with dirty cook stoves and open fires. The chief cause of air pollution, the burning of fossil fuels, is also a major contributor to climate change. Between 2030 and 2050, again, that 20-year period that is now a little over 10 years away, climate change expected to cause 250,000 additional deaths per year, malnutrition because of changes in our ability to raise food, malaria, diarrhea, heat stress. We are seeing an influx, so we have a new Asian tick that will be premiering in many parts of the country this summer. We've got mosquitoes that are much more disease-carrying than the ones that we all grew up with that are now down along the Gulf Coast. And all these things are a part of our international travel and also by the fact that our climate is now more tropical than it was before. Number two, non-communicable diseases. Now, when we say non-communicable, communicable diseases, of course, are those that we transmit to each other. The viruses, the bacteria, the coughs, the colds, the hepatitis that's been ravaging the state of Kentucky. The non-communicables are diabetes, cancer, heart disease. These are things that you don't catch from other people, but unfortunately, you catch from Americanization, American fast food, and the pace that we have, unfortunately, causes many of these problems. 41 million deaths, 70% of all deaths worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. 15 million people die prematurely between ages 30 and 69 years old. Tobacco use, physical inactivity, harmful use of alcohol, unhealthy diet, and again, air pollution, key drivers of the increases in these diseases, which have been introduced into many societies that had better diets and didn't have this before. Three, and we'll talk about this more actually with number eight. This is the threat of a global influenza pandemic. Boy, last year was a mess in the United States. Astonishingly high rates. Not a great response to the vaccination. 80,000 deaths due to either influenza or to respiratory ailments during the influenza epidemic. A lot of problems from last year. This year, softer in the U.S., but worldwide, this could eliminate a lot of people if we did have an influenza pandemic. I'll leave it at that, 1 through 3. We'll start with number 4 in our next fractional portion. That is our sponsor, the top 10 threats to global health, according to the World Health Organization. Now, you may have noticed this air of excitement and also friendliness. You notice how we compliment each other and we're trying to build each other up. Well, that's because we believe in the American Academy of Pediatrics. And on January 16th, they released their new updated policy statement on corporal punishment. First major revision since 1998. And just in a nutshell, parents should not use corporal punishment, including hitting or spanking, either in anger or as punishment. And they also added another thing. They should not use verbal punishment that causes shame or humiliation. So obviously we at Health Matters, I mean, you may remember the second fractional portion slap break where we all slapped each other. That's out. Okay.
So do you want your participation trophy now or later?
Just saying. Can't do that.
It did make me feel better.
The slap session? I mean.
Well. Inflicting it on somebody else.
Well, if you got slapped, I think we talked about that if you cuss real loud right at the moment of the slap,
right,
the pain won't be as much.
Exactly,
Shelly, in her defense, Shelly was in the middle. So when it comes to slapping, she probably got, if I was reaching for Rick, I probably would accidentally slap her.
Good luck.
Once or twice.
Accidentally.
But there's a couple things here.
So we're turning over new leaves.
So first of all, the consequences of corporal punishment, slapping, spanking, it increases aggressive behavior, causes more problems in school and with parents. The largest study that followed children over several years, the ones who were spanked had more problematic and aggressive behavior later. It often led to a vicious cycle where the child became more oppositional, causing more spanking, causing more opposition. So it's not a problem-solving technique. It may make you feel good, especially if done in anger. It does not help the next time. It does not solve that problem the next time.
But Tony, so let's dig in just a little bit. And I'm not saying I disagree, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I want to make that clear. I'm not saying I disagree. But what they're saying, one could translate that to mean that capital punishment doesn't work for prisoners. There's not a deterrent, is what you're saying. What you're saying is the spanking isn't a deterrent for the bad behavior. So how could we not make the same argument that capital punishment doesn't have the same deterrent for breaking laws?
Well, Shelly, that really blew up, didn't it?
I know. We were having so much fun, too.
No, I'm serious. But yeah, think about it. By that same argument, because I think, you know, there's people who are very clear on capital punishment. I'm for or against. And there are people that are clear on spanking. But based on this research, how does that not translate into the
now,
other?
Now, the thing about it is, if you're a parent, justice is not really on the table. You know, that is not – I mean, you want to be overall fair, but you don't seek justice. Say, if your child did something bad, You know, you have forgiveness, you have love, and you're also trying to change those behaviors, but not seek justice. Now, the problem with the penal system, since you mentioned that, is that there are a group of victims who are seeking justice through our legal system, and so you could say, I think you're probably right. I mean, putting people in prison doesn't seem to really to be helpful in behavior. I think there are perhaps better ways to do it, but there is that sense that we need to have justice in our criminal system. And I think as a parent, I never thought that. I was just
trying
to teach them.
Well, I don't mean that specifically to imprisonment or, you know, preventing them from harming others or having a period, a so-called cool-down period for 10 or 15 years. I'm talking about capital. I'm talking about death penalty.
Death penalty.
I'm talking about death penalty here. This is where you could argue the same thing is no deterrent for...
I understand.
You know, and I'm not, and I wouldn't even think of, because when you said justice, I immediately went to justice of the victim, not justice of the
right.
person who committed. As to where a parent's not seeking justice over, you know, breaking a glass on
no,
or something
but,
like that.
I mean, well, for instance, I had a patient today. She had her pinky finger was crooked. And she said she and her brother were playing, and he reached up and he broke her finger. And for the rest of her life now, her pinky finger is crooked. Well, I suppose, you know, if I were the parent, I could say, well, she deserves justice, the fact that her brother did that to her, and that he should be, I should break it. I mean, finger for a finger, right?
So or something
like
that. Wouldn't you say, though, I wish that wouldn't have happened, but that's a great story.
Well, I'm sure they'll both remember
all that. I knew a pair of brothers, right, that one of them hit the other in the back of the head with a crescent wrench. I mean, getting a big old scar in the back of his head, split him wide open. You know, terrible thing to do, but great story.
Great. Well, you may have noticed that I wear my hair long and refuse to go bald because I have such a scar from my brother.
Right. We won't talk about that.
Yeah, it's just a brother thing. But back to it. One of the things they mention, which I think is a great idea, they talk about, especially with a young child, is redirection. Let's face it. If you tell a young child, you say, don't do that. And that's it. That was this child's best idea. Whatever they were doing was the best idea they could come up with. You have now opened the door for the second best, and it's not going to be any better. If you say, don't do that, do this, then you at least give them an option of doing something that you approve of.
I was thinking education. I was thinking, you know, there has to be some element of education involved if we're really going to change the behavior.
They did mention that the teenage years are a bit more difficult to negotiate. And
well, because that's stubbornness.
Amen from us.
That's stubbornness. That's nothing but stubbornness.
But they do say, you know, when we talk about verbal humiliation, you are such a disappointment to me. I wish we had not had you. You are a bad child. You never do anything right.
Dang, buddy, where'd you get all these from?
I'm just saying, that's the
type of thing. Sounds like he's had some practice.
So the thing is, what you do, thanks, Shelley. I've had practice since I've been on this radio show, Shelley. You never do anything right from that middle mic.
We're going to give you some time to think about this, Tony.
True. But, I mean, those are the things we try to eliminate. And we will try to do that from the show because we follow those American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines. We also follow the first segment with a break. That's what we're going to do now. Come back and join us for our second fractional portion on More Ed State.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of health care professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second and not so final fractional portion of Health Matters. Again, I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Hey Ho, the Holly Show.
We shouldn't take breaks this long.
Our salute to William Shakespeare on maybe one of his not
Somebody
best days.
Somebody needed a timeout, though.
Yeah, well, they mentioned timeouts, too. If you missed the last fractional portion, we're talking about the American Academy of Pediatrics on January 16th, their new recommendations on disciplining children. One, corporal punishment simply does not work, does not solve problems, may create a more aggressive child, a more problematic child. That is, slapping and spanking doesn't seem to work, even though I felt like I was making some progress with Rick. Apparently, that's not the case for most people. And then the second thing is they mentioned really harsh and humiliating verbal statements. You don't want to let yourself do things in anger against your children, but especially it's okay to decry the behavior. Again, you can talk about the behavior, but not the person. It's not that you are a bad child. It's just that is a bad thing to do And that must be done in the sense of trying to correct them and steer them to a better thing. Again, the main thing they mention is if you say no, then you should say yes to something else. Otherwise, you're going to get their second best, their third best, their fourth best plan, and it's not really any better than the first plan that was the one that got them into trouble in the first place.
Do you think, is there a chance that maybe the algorithm you learned as a kid was not right, and so your number two actually was better, you just couldn't see it?
No, because you think about it. I mean, when I seldom plan something, I seldom fall back to a better thing than I started. I've done that by luck, but never has my plan B been better than my plan A.
Well, but how many times have you had to go to your plan B?
Well, I don't go to plan B. I number my plans.
Well, you just said so plan B.
So how often do you go
example,
to plan
B? I said for example.
So how often do you go to plan 3? Because I'm about to smack two out of you.
All right. Now, that's ladies and gentlemen, let's point out that I am following the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines.
And
while
I
Rick is over there,
did not sign on that
having
line.
A meltdown and needs some time out. Number 4 in the top 10 threats to global health. This comes from the World Health Organization's fragile and vulnerable settings, regions suffering from drought, famine, conflict, or population displacement. Oh my goodness,
conflict.
Yeah, when you think about that, it is a disproportionate part of, in my mind, the view we have of the world is there are these conflicts. And when you look at the number of people in conflict, the number of people doing battle, the combatants, that is something that it's sort of a noise. It's not that we have World War IV or anything like that. On the other hand, when you look at the effects on the civilians in the region, it is devastating. And I don't know if we used to have battles out in the middle of nowhere or what it was, but we just seem to be determined to basically annihilate our population center with these conflicts. And again, drought and famine may be more important than that going forward. According to the World Health Organization, more than 1.6 billion people, 22% of the global population, live in places where protracted crises and weak health services leave them without access to basic care. Fragile settings exist in almost all regions of the world. These were half of the key targets in the Sustainable Development Goals, including child and maternal health, remains unmet. That is, we unfortunately, with these things, we are creating problems that will persist for generation after generation as we create children that are raised without parents, children that are raised with much more than verbal humiliation going on around them, bombs, bullets, so forth. Number 5, antimicrobial resistance. Time is running out. This resistance threatens to send us back to a time when we were unable to treat infections. And for people in modern age, we cannot conceive of such a time. And yet, there are multi-resistant germs that already we can't treat, and that will become more common. Number 6, Ebola and other high-threat pathogens. Again, I think enough said on that. And then number 7, weak primary health care. Let me say that again, weak primary health care. Primary health care can meet the majority of a person's health needs over the course of their life. Many countries do not have an adequate facilities. The World Health Organization will work with partners to revitalize and strengthen countries' primary health care. And hopefully they might see fit to work with the United States because our primary care health system is in shambles, in my opinion. The problem in our case is not that we don't have facilities. The problem is, in our case, is that we have simply overburdened, not supported, and created a regulatory nightmare for anyone who is practicing primary care at any level. By the way, the reason I am so emphatic about that is that's what I'm trying to do right now. I've gone back to a part-time practice of primary care and am struck by the difference in the regulatory burdens that we have acquired in the past decade. That is our sponsor, the Top 10 Threats to Global Health, and it's another way to get Rick to shut up and kind of calm down the studio.
Look, we're calm.
Okay.
You're the one that's getting upset.
Next up, a bit of excitement in 2019, just to let you know, the FDA reapproves over-the-counter Primatene Mist. Primatene Mist, inhaled epinephrine, was used by many people who suffered from allergies, asthma, coughs, and respiratory ailments. It was taken off the market in 2011. The reason it was taken off the market is because the gas they used to push the Primatene Mist depleted the ozone layer. So the company, because Primatene Mist was really not that big of an item, The company that made Primatene Mist, they decided not to make it anymore. In the past 7 years, the price of the prescription inhalers has gone from $15 up to around $80 per inhaler for the older ones, and the new ones come out at $200 or more dollars per inhaler. And so Primatene Mist, they decided maybe it was time to bring it back. I don't know the price of this, but they could make a pretty darn pricey inhaler and still undercut the prescription inhalers. FDA approved over-the-counter Primatene Mist is proved to temporarily relieve symptoms of mild intermittent asthma in patients 12 years of age and older. I will tell you, the American Academy of Allergy, and I understand their position, they hate this inhaler. It allows people to do-it-yourself their asthma symptoms, and there are many cases of people winding up either in the emergency room or dead because they tried to do-it-theirself asthma. I'm a middle ground on this because the inhalers have gotten so expensive that I work in the free clinic where people try to do-it-themselves asthma without even Primatene Mist. If this thing comes out at less than $50, it could offer some alternative that my patients don't have. But if you hear, if you talk to a doctor about it, they just despair that you're going to kill yourself with Primatene Mist. And the reason is because you're not getting a more comprehensive approach. You're not looking at symptoms, not monitoring your lung flow rates. There are no anti-inflammatory inhalers that cool down the inflammation in your lung. It just simply makes you feel better for an hour or two, and that's not the way to treat asthma. As I said, I understand it, but I think that we shouldn't have increased the price of the prescription inhalers to between $80 and $300 an inhaler, and maybe then no one would care. Anyway, it's back. If you have a call for a minor respiratory ailment, it is available in local pharmacies.
It's a tough topic. I mean, I have an inhaler, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I don't use it that often. I know what I have. You know, mine's exercise induced, which sounds kind of comical, but so I don't use it that much because look at me, I don't exercise that much. So do I always have to go back and get a prescription? And do I always, I know what I need. Having something over the counter that's not, you know, I don't know. I wonder if we said the same thing at one time about Advil when ibuprofen was not over the counter.
Mm-hmm.
Right? At one point, ibuprofen was a wonder drug that is now over the counter and people use it for what they probably shouldn't be using it for.
Yeah. Shelley, what is that? What does ibuprofen do to the kidneys?
Oh, it will do awful, nasty things to the kidneys and to the stomach.
Yeah, we're seeing a generation of people that's been on it for decades, it's rough. I don't know, Rick. Primatene. What we need to do is to get albuterol inhalers, which they last longer than Primatene. We need to get the price down where it's reasonable. But right. But it's like I said, the way our system is set up, it offers you one another option. So armed with that good news, I want to move on then to, this was from the Houston Chronicle, not a paper I regularly read, but I picked it up through a RSS feed that dropped into my email. This is a guy named Dan McCoy, is president of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, and he talked about a rural healthcare moonshot, and that's how it got into my inbox. This is his intro. He says, look, in many rural communities across Texas, the healthcare delivery systems are on life support or maybe they're non-existent. 170 of the 254 counties in Texas are rural, 20% of the state's population. And Kentucky, actually, a higher percent of the state's population is in rural areas. Statistically, rural Texans tend to be older, poorer, less healthy than their urban and suburban counterparts. That's also true in Kentucky. And he goes on to tell how many counties don't have doctors or don't have surgeons or don't have psychiatrists and so forth. The thing he said is we must think beyond asking how do we save the local hospital, which is kind of the heart right now of rural healthcare, or how do we translate an urban healthcare solution to rural Texas? Instead, we need to reimagine the rural healthcare system to connect the dots from telehealth and new types of healthcare workers to partnerships and healthcare delivery tools. And he calls that a rural health moonshot. What would an ideal system for rural Texas look like? And we can ask the same question for Kentucky. Now, he mentions, of course, he's the president of the CEO of Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Texas, president of Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Texas. So he talks about their projects. They're working with Texas A&M to try to address health challenges in rural and underserved communities. They're looking at delivery systems, hospital function and structure, community empowerment, and technology and health information. And he thinks that from that, there might be some solutions that could have a national prominence. I think it's a pretty neat thing to have a rural healthcare moonshot. And the moonshot, of course, means that this is something that's just a dramatic leap, perhaps with additional funding.
Not completely outside of our reach, mm-hmm. but it's going to take extraordinary effort to get there.
Yeah. And first of all, I'll let our radio fans think about the idea of redesigning rural healthcare, not trying to make it look like urban healthcare with fewer people and less resources, and also not just trying to prop up and save the existing system, but to ask let's put some models in place and redesign it so that it's what rural people need.
And Tony, this is going to tie into the third fractional portion where, you know, I just got back a couple weeks ago from CES, Consumer Electronics Show. Now, this isn't based on doctors, this isn't based on hospitals, but it's the biggest expo in the world with technology. I mean, it's huge, and there's some cool things coming down that tie into some of these medical enhancements that you'll find on the doorstep in the coming years.
That's in our third fractional portion. But to continue the idea of moonshots, I've got here a press release from the University of Kentucky.
Is that some kind of drink?
A moonshot?
Yeah, moonshot.
Sounds good, doesn't it? I'd try one if it's not.
I mean, it's a moonshine shot.
Yeah, this is President Eli Capiluto of the University of Kentucky, and also the director of the Markey Cancer Center, Mark Evers. On November 5th of 2018, the Markey Cancer Center promised to cut Kentucky's cancer rates by half.
Did they give a time frame?
No.
It'll take a while for that goal to occur.
Well, if you look at the cancer mortality rate in Kentucky, if you cut it in half, Kentucky would be, by a substantial margin, the lowest cancer mortality in the nation. That's a tough target to hit. I think we can make some progress in reducing our cancer rates, but cutting it in half, I'm not sure they could do this.
Well,
just be honest.
I mean, again, you need ambition and you need the goal to want to get there. And frankly, this is one of those where it's hard to tell if it's within reach or out of reach.
Yeah.
Right? But you certainly want the goal and you want to strive for that. Now, I would look at the metrics a little bit different, Tony. I don't know if I would look at it and compare us to the surrounding states. I would compare us to maybe what we've done in the last 20 years. Right? So what have we done for healthcare in the last 20 years as a society? Not necessarily Kentucky, but as a society as a whole. I mean, we've reduced all forms of cancer. Right.
We have. Now,
but the thing is, can we achieve the same level of reduction for the next period of time?
I hear you.
That's the hard part.
It is. Now, the thing about Kentucky is there is an area where we live in eastern Kentucky where the mortality rates have actually risen slightly over the past 20 years rather than gone down. And so and that's obviously, if you're going to fix Kentucky, you have to fix this area. Because we can, with rising cancer rates in eastern Kentucky, there's still enough people left in eastern Kentucky to pull the entire rates up. 10,500 deaths in 2018, rounded up, from cancer alone, another 26,000 cases diagnosed. This is what they think Kentucky can do. Number one, UK has renewed their Markey Cancer Center National Cancer Institute designation. This is a big deal. It allows them to have access to research funds and additional funding that should help with their cancer projects, but they have to use it wisely. First of all, and I absolutely agree with this, among the most effective rates for reducing cancer is the intervention we take before cancer takes hold. And Shelley, when I told you this, you said, absolutely, that's where we got to start.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of that's going to take policy change, you know, with the smoking, the tobacco use, and things that we have, particularly in eastern Kentucky. And it's going to take more than just money.
Yeah. They mentioned they can implement more HPV vaccination interventions. HPV, a good idea, lowers your rate of cervical cancer, may have an effect on oral cancers and other cancers that are sexually related. Lives saved on that, though, the numbers are pretty small. We have 80 people or less a year that die of cervical cancer. Not insignificant, but not going to cut our rate of 10,500 in half. They also mentioned smoking cessation programs, which is a tremendous thing, and UK has been working on training people for that. And training the next generation of clinical and health leaders to join the fight. Good plan, but not going to move the needle very fast in the immediate future. the second point, precision medicine, targeted therapies. They're talking about using your genetics and the tumor's genetics to deliver good chemotherapy. Not going to have an effect on estate mortality rates. You've got to move further up the chain, prevent it, or pick it up early. Chemotherapy will not bring our cancer death rate in half. And then finally, they mentioned UK is an attractive option for the best and brightest talent, positioned Markey Cancer to recruit more than 30 new experts in the past 5 years, and they will continue. I don't see these things having the impact that they talked about. Recruiting experts, researching chemotherapy, no. Now, I think, again, the smoking cessation is a start, but I don't see those. And so what would it look like if we did have a cancer moonshot? What would it take? First of all, lung cancer, far and away the most common cause of cancer death. It's about 3,500 out of the 10,500 are lung cancer. Colon cancer is a distant second at 850. Breast cancer, 600. Pancreatic cancer, 570. So we've got to address lung cancer. And very simply, we've got to stop people from smoking. We know how to do this. Other states have done this. We have the highest rates of smoking, or among the highest rates in the nation. And all we've got to do is emulate what other states have done. Raise the tobacco tax, perhaps raise the minimum smoking age, ban indoor smoking, make it harder to smoke for kids. And then we basically lose a generation of tobacco addicts that are going to develop cancer. Now, I agree the HPV vaccine is important, but you look at the other risk factors, diet, exercise, fruits and vegetables, obesity, leisure time, physical activity, all those things we're going to have to address. And once again, you can't address those from a research facility. The other thing I thought about, keep in mind, liver cancer, 341 deaths, not inconsequential. If we can stop hepatitis C, treat it or prevent it with needle exchange programs, we can drop our liver cancer rate down. And then finally, we're going to have to work on diet and exercise. And I think one of the things we talked about was perhaps putting some type of a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages and sugary dietary ingredients that lead to obesity, because obesity is a risk factor for almost as many different kinds of cancer as cigarettes. So we want a cancer moonshot. And interestingly enough, it turns out to start not at the university level, but at the community level. With a lot of initiatives that we're all going to have to pitch in on. I think we can do it, maybe not get to half, but we can lower our cancer mortality. And on that hopeful note, we'll end our second fractional portion and come back for more electronic information from Rick. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello, and welcome back. And guess what? This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Hey Ho, the Holly Show. Our salute to Shakespeare's mediocrity with some mediocrity of our own. Our sponsor for the final time, the top 10 threats to global health, and I'll run through the first seven we have already covered. Air pollution and climate change is number one. Non-communicable diseases. This is diabetes, cancer, heart disease, the diseases of lifestyle, and unfortunately, the civilized world, as it's called, the lifestyle that is there with fast food and lack of physical exercise has been exported around the world with a devastating consequence. Three, threat of global influenza pandemic. Four, fragile and vulnerable settings, regions suffering from drought, famine, conflict. Five is antimicrobial resistance. The germs that we have thought we vanquished with antimicrobials, they are becoming resistant, and there will be a time when people will once again die of infections that we can't treat. Six, Ebola and other high-threat pathogens. Seven, weak primary health care system around the world, some due to facilities, some due to devaluation of that particular aspect of health care, instead a worship of the specialty care and high-end care. Eight, you might be interested in vaccine hesitancy. I'm quoting the World Health press release. The reluctance or refusal to vaccinate despite the availability of vaccines threatens to reverse progress made in combating vaccine-preventable diseases. Vaccination currently prevents 2 to 3 million deaths a year, and a further 1.5 million could be avoided if global coverage were improved. Now, our problem in the United States is we have from the vantage point of not seeing these diseases as much as we used to, we have decided we no longer need the vaccines. There is nothing more natural than training your immune system to recognize and vanquish these diseases on its own. But we have lost that edge. And as more and more people go without necessary vaccines, our ability to keep these diseases at bay has weakened. And we see things like mumps, measles, outbreaks that I've not seen since I was a kid. Yeah, mm-hmm. And whooping cough, which can kill small children. It is unfortunate, and it is their number 8 threat. And it sort of adds into the antimicrobial resistance, which was the number 5 threat, and also the threat of a global influenza pandemic, which was the number 3 threat. All those are related to whether or not we will accept the fact that vaccines are very, very useful. Number 9, dengue. That's the first disease. Well, Ebola was 6, but the first single disease they mentioned, deadly mosquito-borne disease, growing threat. 40% of the world is at risk. And once again, with climate change, the area that could be affected by dengue is higher. And then number 10, HIV. Enormous progress being made, but nearly 1 million people a year still die of HIV/AIDS, mostly because they don't have access to either preventative measures or treatment. That's our sponsor, the Top 10 Threats to Global Health. Now, this is a special, we do this every year, and I always get a big kick out of this. Rick goes to the Consumer Electronics Fair, Consumer Electronics Show, in Las Vegas in January. Great deal of sympathy from all of us. And then he comes back just very excited, brimming over with what he sees as the new technology. He does this to protect UK from the new technology.
Well, because in a few Christmases, the day after Christmas we come back, they will show up on campus. I mean, there's no question that we'll be, and there will be a question of why doesn't this work on our network, or why doesn't this connect to this, or, and let's be honest, have you ever known a technology guru who didn't obviously love technology? So they constantly want to stay, you know, familiar with what's coming and how it works and that sort of thing. And so if you're that kind of guy or gal, then this is the perfect place to go.
So tell us what you saw.
So CES, for the folks that don't know, you probably get a week's worth of the news, but it is the largest consumer electronics venue in the world. It's 180,000 people strong. It's invitation only, right? So you, Tony Weaver, could not go. So you have to submit a registration, and it has to be validated and approved that you're part of the consumer industry in some form or fashion, right? So in a sense, UK is part of that consumer affiliate. They're a consumer affiliate because those devices do end up showing up on our residential networks, right? So we can go and we can take part in this. It's a wonderful, wonderful display of kind of George Jetson. What's coming, right?
Okay.
So you get here, and I have to try to explain the size. So there's only one city in the U.S. that can handle this show because of its size, and that's Vegas. It uses between 12 and 14 exhibit halls. They have a whole hall devoted to automotive. They have a whole hall devoted to smart cities. They have a whole hall devoted to, you know, wearables and home automation. You know, so again, you go to all these various venues. So I tend to do a mix of everything because I want to see a little bit of everything. But so I spent a little time looking at drones. How do drones help healthcare? So Bell Helicopter is working on a project for Uber, and it will be a 6-rotor, battery-operated helicopter that seats 6, totally automated flight, flies from rooftop of one large building to the rooftop of another large building, and you can do your Uber back and forth. That's the goal. That's the vision. They're talking about commercialization and availability in 2025. So it's got 150-mile range. Think about that for your EMS or your fast prompt response. Right now, all of a sudden, we can get you in an urban area. We can get you to a hospital in minutes as opposed to, you know, half hour. And then you know as well as I do, what's the most important thing in trauma?
Time.
So we can do that. So this was pretty cool seeing some of these things. A lot of augmented reality. So everybody talks about virtual reality. Augmented reality is where you take your real environment and you augment it with things like Pokemon Go, right? So but you can use augmented reality to train people for certain scenarios, aka maybe a police officer. There's all kinds of cool things they were doing with it. But I spent a little time in the smart cities, and this translates into some of the healthcare areas. And you have to bear with me; it's going to take us a couple minutes to land this ship and get back to where you can kind of connect the dots. there's new technology out there called LIDAR. Everybody knows what radar is, right? Laser-based. LIDAR uses light. And they've created these LIDAR sensors. And if you've ever seen an autonomous car, they usually have some spinny thing at the top on the top of the hood or the roof. That's a LIDAR. And it's basically creating a visual image all around the car. And it's updating in real time. That's why it spins very fast. So they're putting these LIDAR systems in public areas, and they're able to watch. I mean, I saw demonstrations where, Tony, me, you, and six of our friends could walk down the street, and they could identify me as human A, you human B, human C, and then they could track us. They wouldn't know our name. It doesn't have any kind of facial recognition. It doesn't have that kind of capabilities, but it does have the ability to differentiate between humans, between different objects, right? So we can say that's tree A and tree B and car Z, and it has the ability to keep track of all that, or at least the systems we looked at. It can see motion. It can see, you know, all kinds of neat things. It can see somebody when human A does the same pattern over and over and over. I mean, they will be the ability to track that moving down the way, which will tie into a health topic as we move a little farther down the thing. So some of the smart city stuff they're doing with LIDAR and how to track the human movements in the cities is really cool. I mean, and it's kind of deep in the analytics side, but if you like that sort of thing, you could like OD in it. It's pretty impressive.
Now, is this for traffic and crowd control?
Well, it's traffic, crowd. It's for all kinds of applications where you want to know human dynamics or you want prompt response. So they have come up with a fall detection system. So you can put them in your home, and these will be available, you know, probably in 12 or 14 months. They have to commercialize it. But essentially, no sensors, no cameras, it's a box you put on the wall. It doesn't have any recording capabilities. It basically uses things like LIDAR that if you fall, it notifies your emergency response, or it basically gives you an opportunity to say, hey, are you okay? And if you are, then, you know, I don't call the ambulance. But what if you put that in a city seat? What if you had the ability to see emergencies as they happen and go ahead and notify 911 before anybody ever has to pick up their phone and call?
So you would have to look for a human pattern that indicates an emergency.
Distress. A distress thing. Or, you know, people frantically waving or possibly an active shooter. Or, I mean, there's all kinds of things that you can detect based on these images that are created by the LIDAR. I think you're going to see that translate into all kinds of behavior-based research that's going to go on with our cities. So that was one of the kind of medical things is this fall alert. Imagine, wouldn't you like to put a fall alert system in your mother's home?
Yeah.
When we get older, that's our number one.
Yeah, we balked at cameras because of privacy issues.
Exactly.
But, yeah.
Now, tie into this smart city thing. One other device that they showed was a contactless vital monitoring system. I can stand in a position in front of this little machine, and it can detect my heart rate and my blood pressure.
Okay. But this silence was not me being skeptical. This silence was me going, man, that would sure be handy.
Would it? Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be, but now what if you tie that into the smart city system? Listen, if you're able to detect people's heart rate and blood pressure as they're walking down the street?
I understand that. I would be happy to be able to detect it as they come into the clinic. Nothing against the staff of the clinic. I'll be honest. Those numbers would be really handy.
Think about the technology, though. I mean, it's coming. They're going to get there. If they ever are able to put human object A to Tony Weaver, I mean, who knows where we go with that, but that opens a whole bunch of privacy problems, and so nobody was going down that path. Okay. So everything was all about patient.
Right. I get on the Moorhead City website to find out what my blood pressure was at the fair yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, but it's totally doable. Now, here's a thing that we saw. So, Tony, you wear glasses, and you have not taken to the contacts, right? So the contacts aren't your style. So would you classify yourself as a person with good posture or bad posture?
Terrible posture.
So I can change your glasses out, and those glasses will have little flashy lights on the side that will tell you when you're having bad posture moments.
No, they will not. Can I just say, I run from alerts. I am a guy that is constantly besieged with alerts, behavioral alerts and so forth. I can tell you, those glasses will hit the trash can faster than as fast as I can get them off.
Well, I mean, in
theory,
I
understand what you're saying.
First,
you have to want to change your posture. And I do not want my glasses yelling at me. I have lots of things that yell at me right now.
Have you ever heard of a chat bot?
Yes.
So most people have heard of it, but it isn't the most common topic. A chatbot, when we use our instant messaging, sometimes you can just ask the instant messaging system a question, and it'll respond back, and we call those bots. So a chatbot, they've got chatbots now that you can put, and you can put them on your phone or whatever, and you can ask them medical questions about your specific problem. I'm post-surgery or whatever, and I'd like to know how to do this. It will actually answer your questions with a very health-minded response, right? Not just, well, you know, the typical things that chatbots do today are, hey, where's the Orlando airport? Well, it's over there. So they're doing that a lot with chatbots. They're doing a lot with artificial intelligence and putting it on your phone. The other thing they're doing, there's a mobile application right now for people with autism, right? And it actually can, and I didn't fully understand it, Tony. I can't tell you I fully understand, but somehow or another they allow the app, to take pictures and convert those pictures into words to what that person's doing or wants to say. It looked cool, but like I said, I didn't understand the analytics behind it. But the point, I think, of the technology is they're going to start looking at how do we take visual representation of situations and convert it into textual, you know, or vice versa. How do we take a medical record and paint a picture of it? How do we, you know, that sort of thing. I think you're going to see this joining of pictures and
oh, I would
dialogue.
Love that. We've got to get away from typewriters. If you tell me any way to replace a typewriter, a keyboard, I will be a very happy person. I think that's the most ridiculous way in this day and age to put information in.
A couple of other quick little things we saw. They actually had a phone app. No kidding. It acted like a sleeping pill. It was a wearable. I'm sorry. It was a wearable like a watch, and it would use ultrasonic pulsations to put you to sleep. And it was for people with insomnia. And they swore up and down this thing based on research that this thing would basically cause you to want to go to sleep.
Absolutely amazing. I've got to tell you, if we had any alternative to pills, you know how much I hate sleeping pills.
So, I mean, you're going to be able to get a wearable for your insomnia patients, right? My favorite. I nicknamed this one Pee on a Postcard, right? So you have medical tests, right? You want to do certain things. You want to do them at medical grade. So, say, for instance, the hospital or whoever wants you to have the test mails you a postcard. It's a trifold. You open it up, pee on it, and have an app that takes a picture of the strip that's built into it. And then the app tells you what you have, whether you're pregnant, whether you have this, whether you have that. It's out there.
No, diagnostic testing, the same way, has to change. I know that it does. And so I'm all in favor.
We have to get connectivity, though, and service in Eastern Kentucky for most of these things.
Because being on a postcard, we already know we can do it.
Yeah.
Just now we have to get something of value from it.
Well, I mean, there were all kinds of cool things like that. I think what you're seeing is they're going to bring the medicine to the patient. They're going to bring the treatment and diagnosis and the knowledge base to the patient as much as they possibly can.
We're going to be exploring these more as the season progresses. But right now, we need to get off the air.
Special thanks and welcome back to Morehead State Public Radio producer Brian Courtney and to Eric Bilby, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
patients with asthma may recall that in November, Health Matters was removed from the airways. This was due to the gases produced by the show, which are harmful to the environment and are no longer permitted.
The FDA has recently approved a newer version of Health Matters, which produces gases similar to many prescription asthma inhalers. In the FDA approval, Health Matters is indicated for the temporary relief of mild symptoms of intermittent asthma in patients aged 12 years or older and should not be used as a replacement for prescription asthma medications.
With this new approval, it is a fitting time to discuss why allergists, both now and then, have discouraged asthmatics from listening to Health Matters.
The treatment approach to asthma is highly individualized, and patients strongly benefit from a tailored approach from their allergist or healthcare provider, rather than relying on over-the-counter radio shows. The FDA recommends that Health Matters is only appropriate for people with a prior diagnosis of asthma and only those with mild symptoms of intermittent asthma.
The CDC estimates that more than 3,500 people die from asthma every year, so even those with only mild asthma need to be followed regularly. Patients who rely frequently on Health Matters as a rescue radio show to open their airways likely need additional treatment to reduce the inflammation in their airways.
Without control of the inflammation, symptoms may progress, leading to permanent lung damage or to death. Health Matters has side effects such as increased heart rate and blood pressure and is not listed as a recommended treatment in the guidelines for the diagnosis and management of asthma. For these reasons, speak to your allergist before listening to Health Matters.
And also, whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.